Before we get started with today's show, I just wanted to give some love to everyone out there that's been listening to the show over the past year. We did 82 of these episodes in 2016, and the only reason we were able to do that was ultimately because you guys kept listening, sharing, and helping do your part to keep the dream alive. I'm excited to see what 2017 has in store for the show. Hopefully we'll be able to stay on this upward trajectory and keep doing bigger and better things with it. I know a lot of you have done this already, but if you haven't, I'd really appreciate if you took a minute or two to go rate and review the show on iTunes. I know it might seem inconsequential or unimportant, but you know, all of those ratings and reviews matter and add up, and that sort of stuff really matters to my bosses. So once again, thanks for listening this year. Try to do our best to keep the good times going in 2017. And with all that out of the way, let's get to the show.
Regressing to the mean since 2015, it's the Hockey PDO Cast with your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is old reliable Chris Johnston. Chris, what's going on, man?
Not too much. Even reliable during the holidays.
Yes, yes, you are. So this is the last podcast we're going to be doing in 2016, and I thought it'd be a fun exercise for us to do a mid-season awards type show. We can just kind of like put in a little time capsule after this and then revisit it later in 2017 and see how much things have changed. But I thought you'd be the right man to have on since you actually do have a vote. So it'd be kind of fun. We did this last year together. We can kind of go back and forth and see what we agree on, what we disagree on, and where things are trending moving forward.
Love it. Let's do it.
So let's start with a couple sort of, we'll do the individual awards in a bit, but I thought it'd be kind of interesting to start off with having a discussion about the most surprising from a positive perspective and then the most surprising in terms of being disappointing teams. And let's start with the disappointing ones. I think that, tell me which team you think has been the most disappointing this season.
For me, it's probably the Tampa Bay Lightning. Mm-hmm. Just because we're talking about a team that most people, if you look, pick to be in the Stanley Cup or win the Stanley Cup. And, you know, they may still get there. And I know they've had some injuries which have impacted their performance. But, you know, they weren't really doing all that great even when Steven Stamkos was healthy. And, I do think if I was betting that they could turn it around and get into the playoffs, as we're talking right now, they're actually on the outside looking in. But you know, there was huge expectations there. I still think there are, and they haven't really delivered to this point.
Yeah, I mean, the positive thing that they have working for them is this Atlantic division, where I'm not necessarily very sold on the Ottawa Senators. I think the Canadiens and the Bruins are going to be in the playoffs from that division. But I mean, even if the Metro takes the five spots with the two wild cards, it still leaves that third Atlantic division spot open. And you've got all those teams. It's just like going to be like, it's going to be one of the most interesting races heading into the second half. And if the Lightning can finally get healthy, they just got Kucherov and Palat back, which is huge. And hopefully Stamkos will eventually come back and they can start sort of playing together and reaching that upside that we think they have. But yeah, it's weird. Like I had them and the Dallas Stars as my two most disappointing teams, and they're very similar in the sense that they're both on the outside looking in right now, which is very surprising based on how they played last year and what we thought they did this season. They've both been devastated by injuries, particularly up front, and they're both very mediocre this season, just kind of hovering around that 49-50% mark in terms of shots and goals and expected goals at 5-on-5, and it's just unfamiliar territory for these two teams.
Yeah, and you know, the Lightning, let's remember, like they were in the Cup Final and in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Final. I mean, I don't think anyone would have thought that they would have the struggles they've had so far. And obviously injuries play a key factor. Steven Stamkos was having a monster start to his season when he suffered that injury. But I don't know. You just wonder if there's something else going on. I mean, their blue line, where they had Strahlman out for a time, and I know that was very tough. The right side in particular of their blue line was difficult. But, you know, I would think that they're going to be a team that's pretty active leading up to the trade deadline, because they do kind of have this window. Obviously, they've had to do some maneuvering to sign the players they have. They've got a few other guys to sign this summer. And you know, they're kind of in a win-now sort of mode.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like we had this exact same discussion last year. Obviously, they had much more uncertainty with the upcoming free agents, but it's still sort of the same thing where it's this young, exciting team that's sort of been on the edge there for the past few seasons, but you can't just really kind of take it for granted and be like, well, just because they're young, they have time in the future. Like, you should try to be winning right now with this group. So it's going to be fascinating to see how they approach it, whether they go all in and try to make some trades for now, or whether they kind of take a bigger view approach.
Exactly.
What are you doing back there, CJ? It sounds you're like moving.
I just
around.
Got some coffee, if I'm being honest. I just went and poured some coffee.
We're recording this early in the morning, at least West Coast time here, so I'll give you a pass for that. The Nashville Predators were the other team I had on this list, but they've been playing much better since that early funk, so they're a little bit of an honorable mention just because of, I feel like they had such crazy high expectations heading into the season, and they haven't necessarily lived up to it yet, but I'm still pretty optimistic about them moving forward.
Yep, don't have any real complaints there. They actually look like they're playing pretty well, all yep. things considered. It just don't have the results yet that they would want.
Yep, I'm buying that. Okay, let's put a more positive spin on this. Let's go with the most surprising from a positive perspective. Who do you have here?
I'm firing the cannon and saying the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Yes.
Just because, you know, there's no way, no one expected this. I mean, top of the league at this point. Inside their team that they didn't, I don't think they were feeling that good at all, to be honest, about their team heading into the year. But, you know, everything's clicked. They've got a great blue line. I think that's probably driven a lot of help, drive a lot of their success, and obviously received some good goaltending, and it feels like everyone's scoring on that power play. But, you know, to me, they're by far the biggest surprise of the year. And, you know, you have to conclude, based on how they've started, it would be as shocking now if they don't make the playoffs. I mean, they put so many points in the bank that even if they do have some regression coming, you know, they're very well positioned to be in the playoffs. And I didn't see too many people calling that earlier on in the year.
Yeah, I have them as my number one surprising team as well. And where I'm at with them right now, it's a very hot button issue. It's kind of reminds me of the Florida Panthers last year, roughly around this time as well, where they started playing much better and then they rattled off that 12-game win streak, I believe. And, you know, there was a crowd that viewed that win streak and went, oh, you know, they're amazing. They're one of the best teams in the league. And then there was that kind of ensuing pushback of people being like, well, actually, their underlying numbers aren't that good. They're not going to keep winning 12 games in a row. And yeah, it's pretty clear in today's NHL, it's very tough to sustain that sort of a winning streak. And it's generally a combination of talent and luck. But I think if you look at the Blue Jackets, there's a couple things they do pretty well. I mean, Bobrovsky, as long as he's healthy, has played as one of the best goalies in the league and should give him a chance to win on a nightly basis. Their 5-on-5 play has definitely improved, where it's not, at least not a liability anymore. At least they're slightly above league average, and that top power play unit is lethal right now. So I think that combination of things, you put that all together, and it's a pretty good recipe.
Exactly. And, you know, I there's just no one that matches him for that surprise. I thought it was funny, too, Dimitri. I don't know if you remember earlier in the year when John Tortorella went on his Corsi rant.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that was because he got sort of some internal notes or whatever. And the team was doing pretty well at that point. Good start. But that was essentially saying that they were due for a fall off, and he didn't like that very much. So he went on a Corsi rant, but I think he pays attention to this a lot more than he would let on.
Yeah, I believe it. The other team that I had as an honorable mention here is the Boston Bruins, and the results themselves haven't necessarily come yet, but they're currently leading the league right now in pretty much every single 5-on-5 shot metric, and I just looked at sort of historically, they're hovering around that 55-56% mark. And you look at all the teams that have done that since 2007, and there's a lot of cup winners and conference finalists at the very least. And I think, the only team that was in that mix that didn't make the conference final was the 07-08 Sharks, and they lost in the second round. So I'm not necessarily saying that this Bruins team is going to have a long playoff run, but I think that they're sort of lurking there in that Atlantic division.
Huh, that's a good one. I hadn't really thought of them. What about Minnesota in the West? I mean, I know they're also riding one of these great win streaks that might make things look better than they actually are. But
well, I think that
they seem to be getting some results there.
Well, I was pretty high on them heading into the season. The one thing that scared me off a little bit was that I thought that the Central Division would be really good. There was, what, four or five teams there that were all kind of, you know, had the upside to be very scary opponents. But, you know, the Bruce Boudreau addition was huge, and they have a pretty deep team where they can roll four lines and three pairs without much of a drop-off, and they can all skate and play a pretty skilled brand of hockey. So I was pretty high on them. I agree this winning streak has sort of skewed things, and I think that there are some more red flags. It's funny. I think that, you know, for all the flack the Columbus Blue Jackets get as being sort of fraudulent during this winning streak, I think that they're much more legit than this Minnesota Wild team is currently.
Oh, that's interesting. It's funny. People react to that stuff. They don't like hearing it, but, you know, it's just only fair to look, and we're trying to decide what's real, right? Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out, you know, what's going to continue. And you're right, maybe that they will have more of a fall off than Columbus does.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's two ways to approach this stuff, right? We can give them credit for what they've done already. They've banked these wins, but it also is our job to sort of try and figure out what's going to happen next rather than just chasing our tails the entire time.
Right. So we won't plan the cup parade there just yet.
Yeah. I'd hold off on that. Okay. Let's get into the individual awards here. Let's blast through a couple of these easy ones, just because I don't think that we'd have to spend too much time on it. But let's do the Jack Adams. And I don't know. What are you doing with this award right now?
Well, because I don't get to actually vote on this one, and I think I'm in the same camp as you, I'm going to give it to Mike Sullivan, who's just doing a good job coaching a good team, because, you know, we don't see that go that way in the voting very much, but, you know, he's done a phenomenal job, and right now I would have him as my pick.
Yeah, I think Sullivan's definitely in that mix. I have like three or four guys there. It's funny, you know, Tortorella and Boudreau we just talked about. I think they have to be up here just based on how their teams have been playing and how they've been exceeding expectations. And that's what this award really is about, right? It's like where the team was at heading into the season and where they're at now. And sort of you just attribute that to the coach, even if it's not necessarily fully deserved. Like it's generally the players and the goalies. But I think Claude Julien as well, I just discussed the Bruins, has to be up there. And I think that those four guys are sort of in their own little tier. And then you can kind of quibble with the semantics of it.
I see the Bruins are your darling team now, aren't they?
Well, I just think it's interesting. They're not getting talked about much. You know, they haven't had a lot of luck in terms of generating some of those shots into goals. And, you know, they're kind of lurking there in Atlantic Division, and people are talking a lot about the other teams there. But I think that, you know, they have a chance, especially if they kind of start having a bit more good fortune with puck bounces here, that they could put something special together.
Right. And I noticed that the local coverage has been very kind of alarmist that they're down on this team. So, you know, maybe they're in for a good second half, and you will have seen it first.
Yeah. The Lady Bing, do you just like sort by the lowest penalty minute totals here? Like, I don't even really understand the point of this award.
I think so. I mean, I believe part of it, and I don't have the description right in front of me, is sort of gentlemanly player who plays at a high level kind of to get to it. So, you know, normally when you're picking it, I just look at players that didn't take a lot of penalties that had a pretty good season. And that's why I think, you know, you saw Marty St. Louis win it a lot late in his career. So it's not necessarily the guy who ends up with just two as opposed to someone with six. But I didn't even look at it for today. So who's your pick? Austin Matthews, maybe. I don't think he's barely taken any penalties.
Well, the interesting thing for me, and, you know, we generally don't see defensemen win this award, I feel like, but I just basically sorted by the most ice time and then the least penalty minutes, just to kind of see if there was some crazy outliers there. And both Oscar Klefbom and John Carlson are, you know, they're trending towards like roughly 600 5-on-5 minutes so far without a single penalty, which I think is impressive, just in the sense that you think that, you know, both guys are either top pairing or at least top four on their team and play heavy minutes against really good competition. And you'd figure that there'd be an occasion where they're like boxing someone out in front of the net or something, and they have to take a guy down. And it's, I guess it's, you know, it might just be one of those things where in the next 20 games, they could just rattle off a bunch of penalties and be eliminated from this discussion. But so far, it's kind of crazy that they haven't taken a single one yet.
Yeah, I mean, even just getting frustrated, right? Getting beat out of a corner or doing something in the heat of the moment. I mean, that's, for a defenseman, I think it's even tougher. I mean, a winger, you cannot take penalties by, I think, a little easier than someone who's trying to protect the goalie more sort of as part of your job description.
Yep. Okay, now we're getting into the good stuff. Let's do the Selkie, and I think that the interesting debate here isn't necessarily who's gonna win it, but who we put as our third guy on this list, because it's pretty much gonna be Bergeron and Kopitar. I feel like 1-2 until they feel like they don't want to. Like, I feel like just till the end of time, it's gonna be Bergeron and Kopitar 1-2, and we're just flipping a coin.
Yeah, and this year, man, Bergeron looks like he's been having a great year with some of the numbers. Yep. So, I mean, that's probably helping drive your excitement for the Bruins.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that Bergeron-Marchand pairing is just, I feel like people recognize how good they are, and it helps that Marchand got a little bit of that credit with his contract extension this summer and the way he played on the national stage in the World Cup. But I still feel like it's kind of overlooked just how insanely dominant that pairing is. And I think Kopitar fits into this into this bucket as well, just in the sense that, you know, if you look at Bergeron and Kopitar's numbers, they haven't really been producing much. I think Bergeron has something like 5 goals and 10 points in 35 games this year. And Kopitar has, I think, 3 goals himself. And it's really hard to find top guys like this that can have those sorts of offensive numbers, but still have it not necessarily really matter, just because the teams are having such a crazy high volume of shots whenever they're on the ice that, you know, they're just like not really giving up goals against when they're out there. So like they're just tilting the ice completely in their own team's favor and just doing so much for them in that regard. So it's been impressive. So I have Bergeron slightly ahead of Kopitar right now, but I think that the drop off between Kopitar and whoever is third is much bigger than the, you know, the difference between 1 and 2.
That's fair. They're very, very fair.
So who would we even have? I feel like we have to have a third guy here. I think like maybe someone like Ryan Kessler was third, for example. Would we just by default put him in again? Because like a guy like Couturier would have seemed like an obvious fit here, but he's only played like 20 games this season, so we kind of have to scratch him off.
Do you know who I was wondering about? And I haven't heard a lot of talk about him, but it looked to me like Jordan Staal's having a pretty good year in Carolina. I mean, I don't know if he rises all the way to third in the Selke voting, but you know, he's to me, he should be on the radar as someone who's having a really good year helping the Hurricanes, who, you know, we've talked about a lot when I've been on, should probably be having a better season than they are in the standings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wonder about Jordan Staal. You know, what about Sidney Crosby? Would he ever fit somewhere into this? I know it's a personal bugaboo for him that he feels he's overlooked somewhat.
Yeah, well, I think he finished in like the top 10 in this voting last year, I believe. But no, you're right. I mean, we had this discussion with a guy like Joe Thornton last year where, you know, there's these guys where you don't necessarily think of them as being these sort of two-way centers with an emphasis on defense, which is what this award technically is. But like, if you have the puck in the other team's end of the ice very frequently, that's another form of being good on D. So I think that, you know, when Crosby's out there, the Penguins are generally controlling play and doing things in the offensive zone. So, yeah, he's one of their best defensive players just by that.
Now, candidly, Dmitry, when I vote on this award at the end of each year, it's I would say it's the toughest one usually for me to come up with my final list. And, you know, do you have any suggestions for, you know, process ways that I could go about evaluating this when I have to do it? I mean, right now, it's I look at a lot of the simple sort of, if we want to still call them, underlying numbers that I understand. I talk to some scouts and people that I lean on for all of my awards just to help sort of just see, round out my opinion or bounce my ideas off. But, you know, is there any other way that you think that we should determine the order of who wins this award? Because it is kind of a general description, best defensive forward.
Yeah, we don't, it's not very cut and dried. And I think that there isn't necessarily just sort of one metric you could look at and be like, well, this guy's the best in this, so he must be the clear cut winner here. I think that you got to kind of take the whole resume into account. We know that I had Micah on the podcast last week and we discussed this, where it's not necessarily, you know, we thought for a while that quality competition was the most important thing, but we sort of have come to realize that we at least have to factor in quality of teammates as well, because that sort of stuff influences the underlying metrics quite a bit. So I think you got to just like look at a little bit of everything, take a sampling of their entire resume or the entire portfolio and try to figure it out from there. But I mean, you know, Bergeron and Kopitar make it pretty easy for us here, and then you just got to kind of fill in the third guy. I think that the curious thing is, I don't know, like, what is it going to take for us to get a winger into this discussion?
I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's going to happen, does it? I mean, if Marian Hossa didn't ever really end up, you know, as a serious player in it, it's, you know, it's hard to. Is Jiri Lehtinen the last guy who did it? I mean,
I think so. Yeah,
it just doesn't seem to happen. People seem to value, you know, face-offs weirdly in this. I think that that's what some people look at. There's a lot of those sort of things that just seem to discount a winger's ability to make any meaningful impact in the voting.
Yeah, Hossa should have gotten much more love here over the years than he has. So I guess if he didn't, it's going to be tough to make an argument for anyone else. Let's get into the Calder, and there's a bunch of guys here, man. This is a pretty good class. We've been pretty blessed with the young talent that's come into the league this season.
Yeah, not only it's a good class, but a lot of these guys are trending for kind of historical benchmarks that you can say, you know, a rookie hasn't done this since basically Crosby or Ovechkin when it comes to scoring, like Laine and Matthews.
Yep.
You know, Zach Werenski is on a crazy pace offensively for a defenseman that's in a rookie. You know, even Matt Murray still qualifies as a rookie in goaltending. I mean, this is going to be probably a benchmark kind of class. I think that a lot of the players that shine in this season will be the stars in the years to come. And, you know, that's kind of a pretty cool historical precedent, and we're going to have to figure out which one deserves the number one spot.
Yeah, I think right now Austin Matthews has the inside track just because of how big of an impact he's had in, you know, like Laine, for example, has been scoring a lot of goals and producing a lot of offense, but he's still... It's not even that he's not a possession driver, but he's actually been sinking the Jets a bit when he's been on the ice in terms of shot attempts. So I think that, you know, Matthews gets an edge there. And I think that the fascinating thing with a guy like Matthews is you look and he has zero secondary assists at 5-on-5 this season, whereas a guy like Marner has 5. And I think that, you know, even if he can get a couple of those just cheap ones as the year goes along, it'll sort of make his entire resume look that much better. Just, you know, when you look at the point total and you just go like, whoa, that's really impressive. So I think that, you know, Matthews should even get a bit more fortunate as the season goes along there if he keeps just putting the puck on the net as much as he has so far.
Yeah, and you know, he's had a good December, which sort of makes it easier, I think, for looking at the vote totals, because he's very close, and I think he's slightly ahead of Laine in points per game, just behind him in goals per game. And, you know, so the sort of arguments that were being built, I know Gary Lawless wrote a column that got a lot of attention about Laine Matthews. To me, those arguments have been wiped away, because Matthews essentially is producing at the same level in a much tougher spot in a lineup. And he's, you know, he's really the least best player. There's not, to me, to my eyes anyway, I watched the team a lot. I live in Toronto, and you know, I just think that he's had even more of an impact than I expected. I can't believe the number of shots he just generates game after game after game, which is what makes you think, you know, his 17 goals at this stage of the season looks relatively sustainable, because he's not riding a crazy high shooting percentage or anything to get them.
Yeah, you know, it looks totally legit. I think that, you know, for the Calder purposes, not necessarily just for their careers, but for this year's voting, I think the more interesting debate is a guy like Laine and whether he's going to be able to score enough goals where it's going to be just such an overwhelming resume for him versus the defenseman you mentioned with Werenski and Provorov, because, you know, you can make the argument that whether you like Werenski or Provorov more, that they should be the second guy behind Matthews in this voting right now.
Oh, man, you're going to anger the people in Winnipeg saying that, Dmitry.
Well, I think it's a fair discussion to have, and I think even the Werenski versus Provorov one is fascinating to me, because, you know, Werenski's gotten much more attention with the power play production and how well Columbus has been playing, but man, you watch Provorov and he seems like, I think that he could be even better than Werenski. He might not be as flashy and he might not have as many highlight reel plays, but, you know, if you're one of these kind of hockey purists that you just love simple things, like a guy just absolutely destroying a forecheck by himself or making these simple little plays to get out of his own zone, Provorov is already such a treat to watch.
It's amazing, too, that they all went in the first couple of picks in that same draft, along with Noah Hanifin,
yep,
who obviously isn't a rookie this year. But, you know, you get a sense that these three guys will kind of be measured against one another for years to come, just because, you know, there was some interesting wheeling and dealing going on. You know, the Blue Jackets tried to trade up to get Hanifin. They ended up obviously staying where they were, and I think they're pretty happy as they sit here today with Werenski. And, you know, just kind of the way that draft fell and to have such top-end guys come out of it, it's a pretty good start.
The interesting thing about Provorov is he's been really good with everyone except Andrew McDonald, and now they're playing those two together a lot. And I remember last year when the same thing happened with Shane Gostisbehere, and I don't know, I feel like Dave Haxtell is just like hazing these guys a little bit, just making them earn their keep in the league. But like, you have to pass through the test of playing with Andrew McDonald before you get to ride off into the sunset.
Right, life's pretty good. You get to stay in the Ritz-Carlton every night when you're on the road, but you have to endure some tough minutes on the ice to prove your worth, I guess.
Yeah. I wanted to give some love to a couple other guys here. Matthew Tkachuk deserves some credit. You know, the Backlund Frolik Tkachuk line has been rocking like a plus 10 Corsi relative as a unit, and they're right there with the Bergeron, Marchand, Pasternak line as one of the biggest difference makers in the league in terms of just like what the team does when they're on the ice versus when they're on the bench. So Tkachuk's been surprising. I think that, you know, heading into the season, everyone believed that, or heading into the draft process, everyone was like discussing how he was going to be a pretty NHL-ready guy and how he could step in right away. But it's still always reassuring to see a guy to actually come into the league and do it right away.
Yeah, you know, where he's going to get hurt, obviously, is just the points, because he's actually had a good season that way. But it's not going to compare likely to Matthews and Laine. Even a guy like Mitch Marner will probably end up ahead of him in the rookie scoring race, and I think a lot of people will, you know, kind of put their votes around those sorts of things.
Yep, that's fair. Okay, the Norris. This award, in my opinion, at least at this point, is Brent Burns's to lose. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. He's like, I've got him 1, 2, and 3 on my list. I mean, it's funny, this award is always where it seems like the battle lines get drawn.
Yep.
On the Norris. I mean, it kind of exposes, I guess, the difference in the way some people view the game. But Burns has just had such an awesome year to lead the league in shots, and obviously put up great offensive numbers, drive possession. You know, to me, he's Joe Thornton was blowing some smoke when he said he's the best player in the world right now, but he wasn't exaggerating too much, because to me, he is the best defenseman in the league at this point.
Yeah, I mean, he's on an 82-game pace of 30 goals, 80 points, and like 325 shots. And I love looking at the list of defensemen that have ever done that. It's Bobby Orr 5 times, Paul Coffey, Ray Bourque, and Doug Wilson, his GM, did it once. And that's it. So, I mean, once you're kind of – you're not even comparing him to his peers at this point. You're comparing him to just like historically great defense seasons. So I think that it'd be a travesty if he's not number one on pretty much everyone's list at this point.
Now, do you sense, since Doughty got his Norris last year, is there less of a undercurrent that sort of scores have to be settled and we're going to ignore performance when it comes to picking this? Or, I mean, you got your boots on the ground a little more than I do in that regard.
Well, the funny thing is, I honestly think that, you know, the voters seem to generally be kind of late to the party with this stuff, and I could see Erik Karlsson getting a lot of love this season just to sort of make amends for what happened last year, even if, you know, I have Karlsson second on my list right now, so it wouldn't be, you know, completely disappointing. But I just think that, you know, Burns might get shafted again just because it's not quote-unquote his year, which is just a funny concept to me.
Right, it's like the echo of screwing up last year that they have to give Karlsson one more this year or something.
Yeah, no, but no, I mean, Karlsson, listen, like, Burns is having such an insane season that it's getting lost in the shuffle a little bit, but I mean, Karlsson has like the same number of primary points as Doughty has total points, so
right.
Karlsson's pretty clearly number two. I think that the surprising guy for some people on my list that's number three is Dustin Byfuglien right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even have him on my list of five.
Oh, man.
You're going to have to make your case, my friend.
Well, here we go. In terms of all these guys, like everyone, all the top defensemen that would be in consideration here, he is the biggest discrepancy in terms of how his team plays with him on the ice versus when he's not out there, and some of that could be team effects and you know, them not having great options beyond him. But I mean, he's leading the league in ice time right now, which I think would surprise some people, and a lot of that was early in the year when Trouba was out, where he just was playing 30 minutes a night constantly. But I mean, he's just amazing. I feel like we sort of take him for granted a little bit, because you think of him as this big burly guy that's sort of a, you know, a gimmicky offensive type, but he's just insanely good at everything, and he eats a ton of minutes and he's very productive in them. And I don't think there's a very clear cut third guy beyond Burns and Carlson right now. I think Victor Hedman is making a case for it. And if the Lightning get healthy, he could definitely produce a ton of points to insert his name into this race. But I think that Byfuglien sort of sneaks into that third spot for me.
Gotcha. It's funny. You stole my Victor Hedman, because he was going to be my guy that's kind of creeping into this conversation. You know, they're finally going to go from the guy everyone says, you know, future Norris candidate to maybe current Norris candidate.
Yeah, yeah. I think, and then I had Hedman fourth, but I could definitely make the argument that he could be third there. And then I had Doughty fifth, but I'm pretty cool if you want to make an argument for a guy like Mark Giordano, who's also had a pretty good year himself.
Right. Now, this isn't part of the conversation, but I'm going to freelance. Where are you at with Subban and Weber in their performances this year? who's done better, do you think, this season? Not to win the Norris, but just in general.
I think it's nothing's really changed, honestly. I think that, you know, Weber got off to that great start, but a lot of it was just the fact that, you know, his goalies were playing insanely good while he was out there, and they weren't giving up any goals, so his superficial numbers were being boosted a little bit. But it's leveled off as the year has gone along. And listen, I think that Weber's a perfectly fine player. He's a very good defenseman. This sort of stuff happened last year with the Carlson Doughty debates as well, where it's like, you know, there was so much pushback against Drew Doughty winning it that sometimes people lost the plot a little bit by making, you know, extreme arguments just to try to make their case that Drew Doughty's not actually that good. Like, yeah, Drew Doughty's really good. And Shea Weber is still a really good player who, if you use him correctly and sort of play to his strengths rather than his showing off his weaknesses, he can be a very effective defenseman. But I still think that I would much rather have Subban, all things considered, and nothing that's happened this season has changed my perspective on that.
Okay, I was just checking in, just in case.
What, has your opinion on it changed at all?
No, I wouldn't say it's changed, but I'm maybe coming to appreciate some things about Weber a little bit more than I had. I mean, certainly he's, you know, the Habs have not been scored on very much when he's on the ice. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously he's helped their power play a lot. I think most of his goals have come on the power play, and that's been a bonus. So, you know, maybe I can see in the short term why the trade is one that the Habs are willing to make. But, you know, if I was still choosing between the two for my team, I'd be having PK Subban.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, though, that sometimes gets overlooked because Weber is sort of, you know, viewed as more of a traditional defenseman because of his physical nature and how he doesn't necessarily skate that well, but he does have a legitimate offensive impact, particularly on the power play with that shot. And that's something that whenever we discuss his case or where he stacks up against other top defensemen, we don't really ever really consider that often.
Exactly. And I know it's something that Montreal valued and continues to value about him. And, you know, again, it doesn't make up for the trade necessarily, but, you know, it is an area that he's having a positive impact for them. And, you know, obviously they're trying to win a Stanley Cup right now, and maybe, who knows, maybe that sort of thing could help get them over the top in the short term.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's get into we have two awards here left before we sign out, and let's get into the Vezina. It's Devin Dubnyk's world, and we all live in it right now, I think.
Yeah, I don't even see a debate at this point, but yeah. I mean, man, what a season this guy's had. The rise of the former Oilers has been pretty interesting. Even Sam Gagne finding his niche with the Blue Jackets, and Now Devin Dubnyk having a really good season again in Minnesota. And, you know, he's been a difference maker for them. I believe they're among the team leaders in save percentage in the league. And obviously he's an individual leader himself. Mm-hmm. And just hard to poke any holes in what he's done, because he's played the minutes. And he still, you know, has put up numbers that exceed anyone else around him.
Yeah, I mean, he leads in every category. 5-on-5 save percentage overall, you know, quality start percentage, shutouts, goals against. Like, whatever your cup of tea is for goalie analysis, he's probably at the top of the list. I think where it gets interesting is after that, because I have like four or five names here that I'm willing to hear arguments on for which guy should be second, which guy should be third, and so on and so forth. But where are you leaning right now?
Well, I would say this, beyond Devin Dubnyk, it's hard to highlight anyone else in the Western Conference among this discussion, because the East seems to have most of the goalies that are putting up numbers. But, you know, my next was Sergei Bobrovsky. Mm-hmm. In the battle of winning streaks, I guess the two goalies have had a pretty big impact this year. And then at three, I had Carey Price.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about Bobrovsky, and I had Price and Bobrovsky interchangeable there at 2-3, is I'm very curious to see how he holds up this season, because he's never played more than, I think, 58 games in a season, and he's trending towards over 70 right now. I think only the Oilers and I think the Sharks have used their backup goalie more infrequently than the Blue Jackets have thus far. So I think it would be wise as the year goes along, and they've banked some points here to, slow down a little bit with Bobrovsky's usage and maybe give McElhinney or even call up Korpisalo and give him some starts, because I think that, you know, Bobrovsky has had injury concerns in years past, and it's sort of derailed in the past few seasons, and I wouldn't really be playing around with that too much if I were them.
No, especially since they're actually going to be playing games in mid-April and beyond, it looks like. So, I mean, having a view towards the long term is, you know, is positive. It's funny, I think I've noticed more of a trend towards, you know, teams in general being, you know, reluctant to play their goalies on back-to-back nights now. Mm-hmm. Like, we've seen an evolution here, and I don't know if it's just because of some of the stats that have come around or what, but, you know, there's not very many teams that are playing goalies like they used to, frankly, even 5 years ago, and Bobrovsky's one of the outliers so far this season.
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing. I mean, we used to have that era with guys like Kiprasov and Brodeur where they would just be playing like 75 games a season, and I don't think we're ever going to see that anymore.
Yeah, it's funny. Joe Bowen, who's the Leafs radio color guy, or play-by-play guy, rather, got really mad at me because he heard me suggest that the Leafs should keep splitting the goalies on the back-to-backs. He said, well, it worked for Glenn Hall and all this. And I was like, oh, come on, man. I mean, look, just look at the performance league-wide. I mean, there's a reason for it. And especially teams like in the East that play a lot back-to-back, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to risk, you know, injuring your the guy that, I mean, Bobrovsky's clearly been a big part of the Blue Jackets' success, so if he goes down, their season outlook changes dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you are a team with, you know, bigger picture aspirations and you're hoping to play 20-something playoff games, you definitely want to limit the guy to somewhere between 60 to 65 starts in the season. I feel like that's a little bit of the sweet spot right now. You mentioned the Western Conference. I actually have Corey Crawford in my top five.
Nice.
I know he missed a little bit of the season with that injury, but I mean, his 5-on-5 save percentage is just incredible, and I think that his overall numbers have been submarined a little bit just because that penalty killing unit in front of him was so bad at the start of the year. But I think that what he's done, just the overall package, has to warrant at least some consideration on this list.
Yeah, I mean, he's now for sure in any discussion about their core players. I mean, I think that there was an idea when they won, you know, some cups with him that he just was along for the ride, but you know, when you look at the way that team performs, to me, they're not as formidable as they once were, but he's helped keep them among the best in the conference because, you know, his play has been so good. So, you know, I can accept that argument that he's worth the top five for sure at this point because, you know, he's been pretty solid.
Yeah, no, that was the case last year as well, where the performance in front of him declined, and he definitely was they were relying on him to win them games much more than they were in years past. The last guy I have on this list in my top five, and, you know, this is just a Bruins-centric podcast, but I think Tuukka Rask needs to be on this list.
I'll accept that, too. I mean, he had a great start. We've seen him kind of slide back a little bit, which is to be expected, but you know, and I know that you're wearing a spoked bee right now somewhere in your apartment in Vancouver, so I'm not surprised to hear you put Tuukka on the list.
Well, the thing that is very impressive to me about his resume here is just that you look at his numbers versus the numbers of every other backup they've tried to play when they've given him a night off, whether it's been Malcolm Subban or Zane McIntyre or Anton Khudobin, and they've just been an absolute mess whenever he hasn't been in net for them. Like, I think he's hovering somewhere around a 930 almost for the season, and then without him, it's like an 860 or an 870. It's been horrible. So I think that you know that has to count for something, just the fact that how much he means to his team.
Right, and you know, he's probably well positioned to get a bit more love with you know, you pointing out that the Bruins in general should get a bit more luck. He's going to, you know, produce more wins, and mm-hmm. You know, he'll probably, if they climb up the Atlantic standings, get a little bit more attention for his season as well.
Yep. Let's finish off the discussion with the heart. McDavid versus Crosby is pretty much how this is going to be, how this is going to shake out at the end of the season, I think.
Yeah, and to me, if you're going by the spirit of the award, it has to be McDavid because, mm-hmm. You know, the player adjudged to be most valuable to his team. I mean, there's not really an argument there. As great as Crosby's been, you know, that McDavid is you know, has, you know, far inferior teammates and has had such a big impact on the Oilers' success and put them in a playoff position at this point. To me, it's sort of a slam dunk for him. And you know, it's tough to say that. I mean, Crosby's scoring just, you know, what, 0.9 goals per game, you know, this year. But, yeah, you know, he's also got Evgeny Malkin and Phil Kessel in the top 10 and scoring along with them. And, you know, I just don't think the Penguins rely on him to the same degree for their success as Edmonton does with Connor.
Right. I mean, I will say that at the beginning of the year with Crosby out, it was pretty clear that how much they missed him. Like he makes so many things happen for them just by elevating guys, like whether it's like a Connor Sheary or a Brian Rust, whoever happens to be playing with him at that given time. Like he makes, it's not just that he's so good, it's that he instantly elevates like two or three more other guys along with him for the ride. So Crosby is amazing. But I think that even if you go, you know, we always have this most valuable player versus most outstanding player debate. I think if you like search up the word outstanding in the dictionary, I think Connor McDavid's picture shows up. So I think, you know, either way you go with this, I think you could make a very strong argument for McDavid winning this award.
Right. But I think if you remove the team aspect in your judgment, I mean, Crosby's season, I don't know where it's going to go because it does look like, you know, he's probably riding some unsustainable shooting percentages. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for him to put up this kind of goal scoring season, and if it were to continue, I think that there's a strong argument for him because, you know, we've seen so much of him and we've seen so much greatness from him, but it's a new kind of greatness again. You know, I just think that ultimately voters listen to the – can we just change the award? I mean, it's such a strange way to look at it. I mean, if the Oilers miss the playoffs, will McDavid look as – will that change the view of it? You know what I mean? I just find it complicated when we're not just judging who the best player in the league is at that season.
Yeah, I feel like if the Oilers missed the playoffs, it would definitely hurt McDavid's chances just in the eyes of the voters, but I think that's a mistake. I mean, the splits with and without him are, for the Oilers as a team, are very jarring. Like, they're without him, there's been all these arguments about, you know, how guys like Chris Russell and Milan Lucic and whoever they've brought in has changed the, you know, the way this team plays and done all these little intangibles to fix things. But at the end of the day, none of this would be possible without McDavid. And you just look, without him, they're pretty much the same Oilers as they've been in the years past. Really, the only difference is that they're so good when he's on the ice that it's kind of just dragging everything along with him.
Right. It's hardly a sexy opinion, but I've been lucky. I've been to 6 or 7 Oiler games this year, and man, like, you just can't, even if you didn't know anything about hockey, I feel like he would stand out to you. Like, there's not even nuance there. He's just so impressive when he's on the ice. Even the shifts that not a lot ends up happening in terms of results, I mean, he just puts the other team on its heels. And you know, there was once a debate 3 months ago, you know, is this going to be the year he's ready to take over? And basically from the puck drop, he's done that. So, you know, he's been awesome, and you know, he's clearly the next best player in the world, and Crosby's trying to fend him off as long as he can.
Yeah, I think it's well said. CJ, man, thanks for coming on the chat, and I hope you have a happy and safe New Year's Eve celebration, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you in 2017.
Sounds good, Dimitri. Thanks for another year, pal.
Absolutely. Talk soon, man.
The Hockey PDO Cast with Dimitri Filipovich. Follow on Twitter at Dim Filipovich and on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/hockeypdocast.